the next session, and it's my pleasure to introduce Philippe van der Peer, who's a long-time friend and colleague, and he's going to be talking about breast milk pathogenesis.
Thank you very much, Glenda. First of all, I would like to thank the organizer of this conference for inviting me to present an overview on pathogenesis of HIV transmission by breastfeeding. And I think this is particularly timely and relevant since, as you all know, the saga of breast milk transmission of HIV started in this country, in Australia, with the first observation made by our chairman of today, John Ziegler, about 22 years ago. Today, transmission of HIV by breastfeeding is recognized as being the cause of approximately 300,000 new infections each year. But the pathogenic mechanism of HIV transmission by breastfeeding are particularly difficult to study. Indeed, the host, which is the young infant and newborn, are in constant evolution and may be exposed to the pathogen at the moment their mucosal barrier and their capacities to mount a highly efficacious immune response are still in development. On the other hand, breast milk is a biologically active body fluid of evolving and very complex composition. For example, colostrum and transition milk are characterized by a high cellular content that decreases rapidly over time. And concentration of antibodies and of other soluble factors in milk evolve in different ways. And consequently, the composition of mature milk is not comparable at all to the composition of earlier milk samples. One of the characteristics of HIV is to be distributed and to diversify according to the constraints of different anatomic sites. This is particularly true for the mammary gland and breast milk. By a very careful cloning and sequencing of cell-free and cell-associated HIV in blood and colostrum of three HIV-infected women, Pierre Becard from my lab confirmed this compartmentalization. Indeed, in this study, major and minor viral populations were differently distributed in blood versus colostrum and in cell-free versus cell-associated proviruses. In some cases, the major population in one anatomic site were only minority in the other one, like in this case, for example. A major in colostrum and a minority in blood. And in many other cases, quasi-species observed in one were not detectable at all in the others, like in this case and this one. Furthermore, different distribution of HIV quasi-species in right versus left breast and in some women in different fractions of breast milk have been recently demonstrated, suggesting difference in local macroenvironmental selection pressures. This compartmentalization is responsible for different expression of resistance profile between plasma and breast milk being found in half of the women receiving nevirapine in the HPTN-023 study in Zimbabwe. The portal of entry of the virus on baby mucosae exposed to HIV by breastfeeding remains largely mysterious. HIV from breast milk could cross baby's epithelial surface through different potential ways and gain access to lamina propria. By breaches in the integrity of the mucosae, like here, by transport through epithelial cells through a very specific transport mechanism known as transcytosis, by gaining access to digitation of dendritic cells infiltrated into the epithelium, and by transcytosis to a very specialized M cells, which is a cell of epithelial origin, which is present in about which represent about 2% of the Peyer's patches epithelial cells. These very specialized cells do not express glycocalyx nor brush border, and extremely effective in transcytosing antigen from the lumen to a very large intracytoplasmic pocket from the basal membrane, which is in close vicinity with cells protruding from the submucosa. This picture was taken by Marian Nertra a few years ago, and shows the surface of by electron micrography, the surface of M cell from a rabbit, and the attachment of a viral particle, HIV viral particle, at the surface of the apical surface of the cell. The cell membrane receptor, in this case, for this viral particle, is not CD4, but is galactosyl ceramide, which is present on the surface of epithelial cells. These particles are internalized in endocytic vesicles and transported and released at the basal cytoplasmic pocket of the M cell in very direct vicinity with the T lymphocyte from the submucosa. This mechanism has been observed for rabbit M cells, but as far as I know, have never been reported for human beings. Using a very elegant ex vivo model of monolayer viable human enterocytes, Morgan Bomsell showed that free HIV particles were not able to cross human enterocytes by transcytosis. However, when an infected cell is presented to this epithelial surface, it gets polarized, it delivers viruses able to be transcytosed across the epithelial cells, and these viruses are delivered to the submucosal cells. And this transfer has been shown to be able to be blocked by dimeric IgM and IgA present in the lumen. By means of this model, the nature of the interaction between infected cell and the enterocyte surface has been carefully scrutinized. After a very complex cell-to-cell signaling, a true viral synapse is indeed formed as a consequence of the recognition of a membrane egg ring with the viral GP41, that favors interactions between the infected cell membrane and the enterocyte GalCell receptor, and finally trigger transcytosis through an integrin-associated mechanism. However, the infant intestinal mucosa is not the only candidate as a portal of entry for HIV. Indeed, in an SIV macaque model, a non-traumatic inoculation of tonsils with cell-free and cell-associated to HIV was successful in transmitting the virus. Several epidemiologic studies have demonstrated an association between both cell-free and cell-associated viral load in milk and the risk of postnatal transmission to babies. The question is whether both viral reservoirs are really involved in transmission. A clue to this enigma has been obtained by a very careful study performed by Kulinska a few months ago. In babies with evidence of postnatal HIV transmission, she compared envelope sequence as signatures of quasi-species population in infant's blood, as well as in cell-free and cell-associated reservoir in the milk. In early transmission events occurring before 9 months of age, the infant virus cluster very closely to the DNA integrated virus observed in the maternal breast milk. And in the opposite, in transmission events occurring later on, the virus in the infant was much closer to the cell-free RNA reservoir in breast milk. This study showed that multiple mechanisms of transmission may be involved, cell-associated virus being the source of infection in most of early events, and free virus in milk being more frequently involved later on. In order to understand the different functional response of HIV-infected quiescent T cells in milk versus blood, my team used an ELISpot model where CD4 T cells were purified from paired blood and breast milk samples, short-term cultured, activated ex vivo, and antigen-secreting cells quantitated by an immunoenzymatic technique. By this technique, each spot represents a single antigen-secreting cell. That means an infected cell that is able to enter viral cycle and produce variants. In this study, latently infected CD4 T cells in milk were 10 times more frequently entering viral cycle and producing new viral particles than their blood counterparts after activation. This study strongly suggests that local microenvironment in milk may favor transcription of integrated viral DNA from latently infected cells and its translation into proteins and new variants. This may therefore strongly favor transmission, particularly during early stages of lactation when breast milk still contains many cells. But human milk contains also macrophages and dendritic cells. Recent studies have shown that macrophages home in human milk are morphologically distinct from their potential precursor and counterpart in blood. They are spontaneously producing GM-CSF and are frequently expressing DC sign gene and protein. They are also a likely source of most of the breast milk dendritic cells, as they differentiate into CD1 plus dendritic cells after incubation with IL-4. These DC sign positive macrophages and dendritic cells have been shown recently by Satori and co-workers to be able to transport R5 viruses in breast milk. As already mentioned, human milk is extraordinarily rich in soluble factors, some of them with immunomodulating or anti-infectious properties. Lactoferrin, Lewis X factor, Sleepy, and alpha defensins have all been suggested, either in vitro or in vivo, to modulate transmission by interfering with viral attachment and entry or interfering with local immune environment. Many of other components, such as lysozyme, complement factors, interleukins and other cytokines, mucins and prostaglandins, are still to be studied and are the subject of ongoing studies in many groups. Some of these soluble factors are in fact HIV antibodies that were shown to be detectable in all breast milk samples from HIV-infected mothers. Surprisingly, many of these antibodies are IgG. Some of these probably translating from the vascular compartment at the secretory IgA and IgM appeared less frequently. When present, however, local secretory IgA and or persistent of IgM were also associated with an absence of transmission in this study in Rwanda many years ago. Although two subsequent studies based on different population and different techniques failed to demonstrate a protective role of these antibodies, it remained plausible that transmission with HIV through transcytosis across mucosal cells or other mechanisms may be modulated by the humoral local response. The complexity and the multiplicity of pathogenic mechanism of HIV transmission by breastfeeding raise more questions than certainties. Breast milk transmission of HIV is clearly multifactorial, and recent studies have, however, contributed to explore this. The exact picture is still not known, but certainly involve a very complex intercompartment cell trafficking, some being fueled by a very complex viral populations, modulated by an extremely rich and diversified microenvironment in milk. The more intriguing question is presently, why is the majority of infants exposed to HIV through breastfeeding escape HIV infection, despite the fact that they ingest each day an estimate of 300,000 viral particles and 25,000 infected cells? As shown as Francis Baran recently, local humoral response and neutralizing antibodies may play a role. Also, as shown by studies from Stephanie Sabage and Barbara Lohmann, an immune T-cell response is also present with a specific anti-HIV MHC class 1 restricted CD8 positive CTLs in milk. But other immune factors, especially unrecognized innate immune factors, may be acting as well. With this respect, surprise may welcome from very powerful new technologies. For example, the proteome of the human milk contains large unexplored area. As an example, a powerful liquid chromatography tandem mass spectrometry tools have considerably improved the knowledge of proteomics, such as in recent studies by Smolensky that identify several thousands of peptides in bovine milk, many of them being immunologically active and others of totally unknown functions. At least four trials and well-structured observational cohorts are testing the efficacy and tolerance of administering highly active antiretroviral treatment to HIV-infected lactating women, with the hope to reduce breast milk viral load and HIV transmission to the babies. In the previous session in this conference, we learned very preliminary data from two of these cohorts with extremely promising results. It should be kept in mind, however, that the maternal antiretroviral are not likely to completely annihilate breast milk transmission of HIV, as antiretrovirals have little short-term impact on the cell-associated HIV in breast milk and eradication of potential cellular reservoir. Promising alternative interventions are also the subject of evaluation through clinical trials, such as post-exposure or pre-exposure prophylaxis with antiretroviral given to exposed infants only, or mucosal vaccine candidate, or treatment of expressed milk by EAP or microbicides. Finally, we should recall that the very close cousin of HIV, HTLV-1, is a retrovirus that is transmitted from mother to child by breastfeeding almost exclusively through a cell-to-cell transfer of viruses. Breast milk transmission of HTLV-1 has been considerably reduced by freezing and thawing of expressed milk, an example that may be interesting to test in this occasion to prevent transmission of HIV. I thank you for your attention.
This paper's up for discussion. We can take one question. I see someone coming. No, she's not. She's leaving.
That was so boring.
Barbara Abrams out of UC Berkeley showed pretty efficiently and effectively that boiling of breast milk will kill the HIV. I was wondering if you could speak to that, because I saw you had freezing and thawing. Does the boiling process also denature proteins that would be good immunologically, or what's the deal?
Yes, you're completely right. There are some studies evaluating pasteurization or boiling of breast milk, and evidently it has a huge major impact on the infectivity of breast milk, both on most probably both on cell-free and cell-associated viruses. But as you mentioned, it could interfere also with the effectiveness of all those soluble factors, especially proteins, who are not thermostable and may be affected by this. Also, practically, it may be quite difficult in the field to use this alternative. But I know also that there are at least a couple of sites in Africa where this procedure is tested in real life, and it will be quite interesting to have results from those trials.
Thanks. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Philippe. The next speaker is Ruth Ndwati. Ruth is Professor of Pediatrics and Child Health in Nairobi, Kenya.
Yeah. Let me begin by thanking the organizers of this meeting for inviting me to make this presentation. Now, during the first year of life of a child develops rapidly, moving from a milk-only diet in the first 6 months to a mixed milk and weaning diet in the next 6 months, and finally achieving full adult diet by the age of 2 years. Now, breast milk meets all the nutritive needs for the child in the first 6 months of life and continues to contribute significantly until the child reaches the age of 2 years. Now, these buttons are not moving. This one? Okay. Now, the question of whether breastfeeding is best for HIV-exposed infants in resource-constrained settings is best addressed by considering magnitude, timing, and correlates of breast milk transmission, mortality associated with HIV infection and with different modalities of feeding, morbidity associated with the different modes of feeding in the early newborn period and following the weaning, early weaning, and finally HIV-free survival associated with different feeding modalities and the effect of ARV prophylaxis for PMCT. There are four distinct patterns of feeding: the very young infant, exclusive breastfeeding, when the baby receives breast milk only, plus medications and multivitamins; predominant breastfeeding, when the baby is breastfed and in addition receives non-milk fluids but no solids; and then partial breastfeeding, also called mixed feeding, where the baby takes other milks and liquids as well as solids in addition to breast milk; and then replacement feeding, where the breast milk is not part of the infant's diet. As we proceed, please consider the following scenario. Mary is a 20-year-old woman expecting her first baby. She does not have access to HIV testing, but is concerned that she might be infected. What advice would you give her regarding infant feeding? With a slow rollout of PMTCT programs, this is a commonest scenario facing pregnant women in sub-Saharan Africa. Let's note that even in the context of a generalized HIV epidemic, the majority of women are HIV negative. Counseling on infant feeding should be based on the assumption that Mary is HIV negative. The optimal infant feeding choice for Mary is exclusive breastfeeding for the first 6 months and then continue breastfeeding and complementary feeding into the second year of life. She will need skills on proper infant attachment to the breast to prevent nipple and breast disease, conditions associated with very high breast milk transmission of HIV. She also needs counseling on HIV risk reduction using dual contraception, condoms, and an effective planning method. And it is worth noting that to date, the programs that have successfully promoted exclusive breastfeeding are characterized by weekly and fortnightly home visits for a breastfeeding mother for up to 6 months. I think part of the discussions that we should come away from here is how that can be implemented in the typical public health setting that is in sub-Saharan Africa. In the HIV unexposed infant, appropriate infant feeding is this exclusive breastfeeding in the first 6 months of life, and then complementary feeding following that. Exclusive breastfeeding, which is a gold standard for young infant feeding, is not the norm. In fact, the norm is mixed feeding with a lot of prelactial feeds being given to babies. This slide on a study by Bao and colleagues presents some of the evidence supporting promotion of exclusive breastfeeding. In this study of children living in some of the most deprived environments in the world, the slums of New Delhi, Lima and rural Ghana, non-breastfed babies had aged 6 weeks to 6 months had a tenfold increased risk of dying compared to the babies who are predominantly breastfed, while partially breastfed babies had a twofold increased risk of death. These findings are very similar to the data that has been presented for HIV-exposed children. Today, 90% of HIV-infected children, or 90% of children who are exposed to HIV live in sub-Saharan Africa, a region where 41% of the 10 million under 5 child deaths take place annually. We estimate that 13% of these deaths could be prevented by appropriate breastfeeding practice. Therefore, infant feeding counseling for HIV-exposed children needs to take into account the risks of HIV infection as well as the environmental hazards that these children are exposed to. Now, there are many studies that have looked at breast milk transmission of HIV. The early studies are largely observational, while later studies are interventional in nature. And often with women self-selecting method of feeding and sometimes being randomized to breastfeed or formula feed. The exposure variables that have been looked at have also varied. Everything from comparing any breastfeeding versus replacement feeding, as well as comparing the different categories of breastfeeding, exclusive breastfeeding, predominant breastfeeding, and mixed feeding. Likewise, the outcomes of interest vary from rates of HIV infection, mortality, diarrhea and pneumonia-related morbidity, and HIV-free survival. Now, this analysis in some studies are carried out for all the children, while in other studies they are stratified by infection status, and in others they only present data for children who are not infected. Now, some of these study designs present challenges in addressing the question of breast milk transmission of HIV. In observational and interventional cohort studies, one is not able to distinguish between late pregnancy, intrapartum, and early postnatal transmission. And therefore, the rates that are reported underestimate the risk of breast milk transmission. Now, the development of the antigen-based techniques for infant HIV diagnosis have opened up new opportunities for examining the timing of breast milk transmission of HIV. But to this then has come variability in the period of observation of postnatal transmission. Now, in many studies, sicker women often opt for replacement feeding or mixed feeding. Both factors are independent of child's HIV infection status are associated with adverse infant outcomes. There are efforts in the studies to control for some of these problems, but very often the studies don't collect enough data. You don't. Sometimes you have CD4 counts, sometimes you have viral loads, sometimes you may have CD8 counts. And even when you control for these biological factors, there are other factors associated with child survival which may differ per modality of feeding, such as poverty, literacy levels of the mother, and even access to basic amenities like healthcare. Now, randomization, which is justified when there is equipoise, is currently the best known method of controlling for measured and unmeasured potential confounders, and may help us in answering these questions. To date, there are two published studies randomizing women to breastfeed and formula, one in ARV-naive women and the other in women who have been exposed to effective or antiretroviral drugs. Now, an additional problem with the research studies is that they lack uniformity in the duration of follow-up and for the varying study points. Some of the studies you see 6 weeks, 6 months, 7 months, 18 months, 24 months. And this does introduce bias. An example of this bias is, for example, that babies who are on replacement feeding have early mortality compared to babies who are breastfed. So if your study only follows babies up to, say, 6 months, then you underestimate the adverse events that may be associated with breastfeeding and HIV infection, as shown in this slide. There are also other problems related to these studies, that the timing of blood sample collection to determine when infants were infected. If babies miss their visits, then the period of the timing of infection may be assigned to a different time period than it really happened. Nevertheless, we have lots of data to show that there is breast milk transmission of HIV. The earliest reports, as you heard, were from case reports and cohort studies. An early meta-analysis by Dan et al. Has held true to date, where the added risk of HIV transmission for women with established HIV was about 14%, and for women, and 29% for newly infected women. Now, the two studies that have evaluated breast milk transmission of HIV using a randomized trial design confirmed this data. The Nairobi study of ARV-naive women found a cumulative HIV infection rate of 20.5% in formula-fed moms and 36.7% in breastfeeding moms. And so the overall estimated transmission rate in these mothers who are ARV-naive was 16.2%, and 44% of the transmission in the breastfeeding arm was attributable to breastfeeding. The MASHI study, which was published more recently, is a randomized, where women exposed to efficacious ARV regimes and randomized babies to breastfeed or formula feed. Breastfed babies had 1 month of azidovudine in addition to the antenatal and peripartum ARVs. When we followed the babies to 18 months of life, there was higher HIV infection rates in babies who are breastfed, 9.8% versus 6.0%, and overall, 37% of the HIV transmission in the breastfeeding arm could be attributed to breastfeeding. Now, babies are at risk. This is not moving. Okay. Babies are at risk of HIV infection as long as they are breastfed. In ARV-naive women, most breast milk transmission takes place early, 63% by 6 weeks of life, 75% by 6 months, and 87% by 1 year. And the estimated risk of HIV infection per day of breastfeeding is very similar to estimated risk per exposure to unprotected sex in adults. Now, the quality of breastfeeding matters. And mixed feeding is dangerous, and it increases the risk of HIV infection. Three large studies have been done and reported their data. This slide is from the South African study by Dr. Professor Kuvadi and colleagues. These are babies whose median duration of exclusive breastfeeding was 159 days. The main findings from this study is that mixed feeding before and after 14 weeks was associated with significant increased risk of HIV transmission in breastfed infants. This study is particularly good because we're able to show that the group that were exclusive with breastfeeding was very similar to the group that was having mixed breastfeeding in terms of their baseline characteristics. And this slide shows some of the CD4 counts in that group. In further analysis, when they stratified compared mothers who did mixed feeding, who gave babies solids, there was an 11-fold increased risk of transmission. Now, the lowest transmission rates in this study was among babies who are on replacement feeding, and the authors note that, in fact, those two babies who were infected in that arm of the study had been breastfed. Now, late postnatal transmission is important, and this slide shows that it ranges from 6.9 to about 9.2 per 100 child years of follow-up, and overall, late postnatal transmission rates are pretty comparable across the different studies. In the first two studies there, the Ditram Plus study and the Vitambo study, they also showed that even in late postnatal transmission, babies who are exclusively breastfed have lower risk of transmission. And these are the blue bars. Now, there are other factors that contribute to, that need to be considered in breast milk transmission. Mother's disease status is important. In the work from Nairobi, we were able to show that mothers with high plasma viral load and low maternal CD4 counts were independently associated with breast milk transmission. In the same study, we demonstrated that HIV virus shedding in breast milk was associated with genital shedding of HIV virus in the both vaginal and cervical shedding of virus. And it may be that these mothers who transmit are different from others. We also showed us that both cell-associated and cell-free virus was associated with transmission. Now, in the Vitambo study, they showed that mothers who have low CD4 counts, that 33% of them transmitted. So there was 33% transmission in babies who were uninfected at 6 weeks and who continued to breastfeed for a prolonged period of time. In the study by Kudvadi and colleagues, for babies who breastfed for their 6 months, if their mothers had low CD4 count, 34% of them also were infected. So mothers' HIV disease status is an important driver for breast milk transmission. Now, when we look at outcomes, the single most important factor that determines the outcome of these babies is HIV infection status. In the Nairobi study, we show that there's a 9-fold increased risk of death if the baby is infected. In the Ditram Plus study and the study from South Africa, the babies had infected babies had a 15-fold increased likelihood of dying if they were infected. Now, the morbidity is also important because, diarrhea, pneumonia, and other such conditions affect the quality of life of the child and put them at risk of dying. In the Nairobi randomized trial, we did not find that we found that the incidence of diarrhea, pneumonia in breastfed and formula-fed babies was similar. The incidence of these conditions was higher in HIV-infected children, but there was no difference between breastfed and formula-fed babies. In the Ditram study where mothers self-selected to breastfeed or formula feed, they found an significant increase in diarrhea and pneumonia among babies who were breastfed. In the MASH study where, where mothers were not selected in terms of AFAS criteria, there was increased diarrhea and diarrhea morbidity. Now, this slide is from the study in Kisumu, showing what happened when babies were weaned early. This slide looks very much like the data also from Malawi, showing that there's an increase in the incidence of diarrhea when babies are weaned at 6 months, and that the diarrhea is serious enough for babies to be admitted. Now, this study did not report an increased mortality, but these are children who are in a clinical trial and accessing good clinical care. Now, I think the best judge of what is safe for babies is really looking at HIV-free survival of infants. And this slide summarizes data from 4 studies and shows that when you look at the HIV-free survival of infants who are breastfed or formula-fed, there's no difference. The difference you see is that in the studies where there's the mothers accessed antiretroviral drugs, the 2 studies, the MASH study and the Ditram Plus study, the HIV-free survival of breastfed and formula-fed babies was much higher than in the earlier studies where there were did not have access to antiretroviral drugs for PMTCT prophylaxis. So what does this mean in terms of counseling? It means that For mothers who meet AFA's criteria for replacement feeding, if a mother truly wants to do that, I think there's reasonable we have reasonable confidence that to say that from the data that there's no added risk of dying because they are doing replacement feeding. But more important is the fact that these babies who are breastfed do not have an added risk of death compared to babies who are on replacement feeding, in spite of having higher breast milk transmission rates. Now, I want to close off with this case scenario because I think the case scenarios illustrate really the problems we have. Akinyi is a 25-year-old primary school teacher expecting her third child. The two other older children are not alive, having died of HIV-like illness. She is WHO clinical stage 2. Her CD4 count is 180 cells per millimeter cubed. Heart is available at the district hospital, which is 80 kilometers away. She wants to delay ARV initiation until after delivery, when she can move about much more easily. She lives in a region of the country where the only way to get to these facilities is to walk or on a bicycle. What advice would you give her regarding infant feeding? This is a very common scenario for us who are practicing in sub-Saharan Africa. Akinyi is at very high risk of infecting her infant through breastfeeding. As I said earlier, in studies by Kuvadi and others, she has the likelihood of 30% transmission rate, even with 6 months of breastfeeding. Without ARV, she has a 14-fold increased risk of dying if she breastfeeds her baby for a prolonged period of time. And therefore, every effort should be made to put her on heart. And she should also be counseled that baby replacement feeding may be safer for her infant. If AFA's criteria is not met, then she should be counseled to exclusively breastfeed. And we know that if she exclusively breastfeeds, her child has a threefold reduced chance of breast milk transmission as opposed to if she does mixed feeding. So the challenge is that for us to be able to make a difference for these mothers, we have to access them the other package of care, the antiretroviral drugs, which will protect breastfeeding. This is my second last slide, which shows what progress has been made in the prevention of mother-child transmission of HIV. And I've added the two studies that were presented in the session just before us. If we are able to deliver effective antiretroviral drugs for PMTCT to women in sub-Saharan Africa, then we will be able to protect breastfeeding, and their babies will benefit, their infants will benefit from breastfeeding, and the ARVs will protect their mothers from HIV disease progression and transmission to their infants. So in conclusion, breastfeeding transmits HIV, and 38 to 44% of all transmission in breastfeeding babies is attributable to breastfeeding. Mixed feeding, and especially addition of solids in the first few months of life, is dangerous, associated with a tenfold increased risk of transmission. Shortening duration of breastfeeding to 6 months will prevent about two-thirds of late postnatal transmission. And the data from observational studies show that both intervention and observational studies show that use of heart during breastfeeding period and shortening breastfeeding to 6 months offers babies the best option for HIV-free survival. Thank you.
Thank you, Ruth. We're pushed for time, but we can allow one short question if someone would like to come to the microphone. Some people take that as a cue to leave.
Yeah, I don't think there are any questions.
Do we have any questions for Dr. Duarte? We may have time to come back for some further general discussion at the end.
Thank you, Ruth.
Yes. I was not there at the retrovirus, neither I read the abstract from Botswana, but you haven't included the results from the Botswana where they did show the high mortality in breastfed infants over time. Sorry, in replacement period infants over time. Could you comment on that? Why you didn't include that?
Yeah, I don't know whether it's possible to go back. I'll be happy to comment. The slide that I showed on HIV-free survival takes into account mortality and HIV infection. And the MASH study from Botswana showed clearly that the HIV-free survival of breastfed and formula-fed infants was the same. There was no difference. The formula-fed babies had higher mortality, and a lot of that mortality was in HIV and infected children. But the breastfed-feeding babies had more HIV infection. And when you took HIV-free survival as your outcome of interest, there was no difference in the two arms of the study. Just like, you know, even in the South African study of exclusive breastfeeding, when you compare HIV-free survival of those who are replacement-fed and exclusive breastfed, there was no difference.
Thank you very much.
Can we have Sam Walters, who's going to talk about the issues around diagnosis and management of kids who are co-infected with HIV and TB. Thanks, Sam.
I'd like to start by thanking the organisers for asking me to speak here this afternoon. I'm an infectious diseases paediatrician working in London, and I've spent much of the last 17 years looking after children with HIV infection and children with tuberculosis. I made this slide back in 1990 when we, in fact, knew very little about adult HIV infection and even less about this infection in children. And I used to use this slide to illustrate the point that what we do learn about adult HIV would not necessarily translate into pediatric practice. I think I can still use this slide today when talking about HIV-TB co-infection in children. We do not know enough about this co-infection in adults. There is not enough data, and there is a woeful lack of data in pediatric practice. And I think we need to remind ourselves that what data is generated from adults will not necessarily translate into pediatric management. It is a fact that the global society is unfair in that those who live in a resource-rich environment usually have good access to healthcare, and the opposite is for those living in resource-poor. And HIV-TB co-infection is very common in many resource-poor environments, and this is perhaps best illustrated by sub-Saharan Africa, where children living in this region probably have the greatest burden of this co-infection. I first will move on to challenges in the diagnosis of tuberculosis. I'm not going to talk about diagnosis of HIV in children. And it's important to say that we not only need to diagnose active tuberculosis in children, but we need to know about latent MTB infection, because there are issues of prophylaxis. The gold standard of diagnosis for tuberculosis has always been microbiological, but this has a very low sensitivity in paediatric practice, at best 10 to 15%. And this is due to a number of reasons, but one in particular is that most children with tuberculosis have Porcy bacillary disease. It's also very difficult to get sputum samples from young children. If we try and make the TB diagnosis from symptoms, there is overlap with HIV disease, and fevers, failure to thrive, and weight loss, along with persistent and chronic respiratory illness, are common to both infections. Similarly, if we try and make the diagnosis with chest radiology, there is considerable overlap. And before the HIV epidemic, I think all of us would have been happy to diagnose both of these children as having Miliary TB, but one has LIP, and to my eye, there is no difference radiologically between these conditions. The tuberculin skin test has been in medical practice for over 100 years, but it is of limited use in young children. And if these young children also have HIV infection, it is even less useful. This is a study from South Africa confirming this, and disappointingly, trying to factor in the child's CD4 count in order to improve the sensitivity of tuberculin testing did not make it more valuable. In many parts of the world, tuberculosis in children will be diagnosed using an algorithm or a score system based on contact history, symptoms, radiology, and skin testing. And this has proved to be very useful in many areas, unless the child has HIV infection. And these are two studies, one from South Africa and one from Zambia, showing that these score systems do not work in the presence of HIV. There are new diagnostic tests, and the T-cell-based tests, for which there are two commercially available assays, are useful in distinguishing between MTB infection and prior exposure to BCG. And this is very useful. However, these tests are expensive, they require a laboratory infrastructure, and you need trained personnel to perform them. In their current form, they do not distinguish between active TB and latent MTB infection, and they're not yet adequately validated in HIV-infected children. Data are emerging, and this is a study from KwaZulu-Natal showing that the sensitivity of the ELISpot, which is just one of these commercially available tests, was vastly superior to the tuberculin skin test. And at this meeting, there is a poster from a group in the Western Cape showing the ELISpot sensitivity of 80% in HIV-infected children with active tuberculosis. So this is probably going to be useful to us, but we need more data. Moving on to the challenges of treatment, the first thing to say is that we cannot delay treatment of active tuberculosis. It must be started immediately. And the question arises is, when should we start treatment for HIV? And one of the issues here is immune reconstitution disease, also termed IRIS. I will stick in my talk to this, referring to it as IRD. I think a good definition of this involves the restoration of pathogen-specific immune responses during antiretroviral therapy. And it presents as subclinical infections being unmasked or partially treated infections getting worse. In adults, it is more likely to occur if HIV therapy is started within 2 months of starting TB treatment, if TB is extensive, if HIV is advanced, and if you get a good early response to your antiretroviral therapy. And it is of interest that in adults, when they repopulate their CD4s, this is predominantly memory CD4 T cells. In children, this will predominantly be naive CD4 cells. And whether this will have an influence on the pattern of IRD we see in children, we just don't know yet, because there is precious little data. It does occur in children. There are case reports, and there are a series of children starting on antiretroviral therapy in which IRD has occurred. The management of IRD, we lack data for that of management in adults, but if mild symptomatic treatments may be helpful, but when severe, steroids are used, and we don't know how long or what dose or how dangerous steroids are. There is no controlled data. It is better to try and delay, prevent IRD by delaying HIV therapy, and do that for 2 months if you can, or even better, for the whole of the time of TB treatment. However, there is a significant mortality in adults from South African data during that first 2 months of TB treatment. This busy slide, because of time, I will pass over, but I've encapsulated the data here, that what needs to be balanced is the early mortality if you delay ART against the incidence of immune reconstitution disease if you start ART early. And we don't know how to weigh these issues in adults and where the balance should be pitched, and we certainly don't know where to put it in pediatric practice as yet. Other treatment challenges would be drug interactions, and particularly we're talking about rifampicin, which we know induces hepatic P450 cytochrome complex. Mostly, rifampicin will not have an effect on NRTIs, but we know that triple NRTI regimens lack potency, and particularly as many children have very high viral loads, we would not promote this as the way forward for pediatrics. The non-nucleotide reverse transcriptase inhibitors, the data show that rifampicin will reduce the area under the curve for nevirapine by about a third, and for rifampicin by about a quarter. It is possibly all right to use standard dose of rifampicin. There is adult data which was presented in this meeting yesterday by a group of previously reported good short-term results with rifampicin and standard dose of rifampicin in adults. Now they presented long-term data showing that the HIV control is good. For nevirapine, well, recommendations are have been to increase nevirapine by anything between 20 and 50%. Again, yesterday, some adult data from a group in Thailand showing that putting the nevirapine up to 600 milligrams instead of the standard 400 milligrams achieves equivalent virological control at 24 weeks. Now, we don't like 24-week data in HIV practice, but it's interesting, particularly as those adults on the higher dose of nevirapine had significant increase in side effects. The protease inhibitors are mostly incompatible with rifampicin. You can use ritonavir with rifampicin, but I don't think anyone should prescribe ritonavir liquid to children without first tasting it. It is disgusting. And giving ritonavir to children is really quite difficult. Calitra, possibly we can use by increasing the amount of ritonavir we give so that we boost the lopinavir levels, and this is some data from a Dutch group in adults showing that you can achieve adequate lopinavir levels by giving extra ritonavir. I've seen unpublished data from the Western Cape using a similar protocol in children that seems to get over this, and maybe that will evolve. The problem with rifampicin is really worrying, because if we overdose an antiretroviral for children, we're likely to produce toxicities, which short-term is very uncomfortable for them. But if we underdose it, this will promote HIV resistance, and this is a long-term disaster for these children's HIV care. In a resource-poor country, treatment of HIV-infected children has to go down the route of fixed-dose antiretroviral combination tablets. But if we're going to use rifampicin, we're going to need to augment individual components of these drugs, and this is extremely difficult. In a resource-rich country, we can increase the dose, do therapeutic drug monitoring and adjust the dose, and it sounds straightforward, but it isn't. It is extremely difficult, and many of us have moved to using rifabutin instead of rifampicin to try and avoid the problem of incompatibility. Now, I've no idea how difficult it is to manufacture this molecule, but it may be that this is the direction we have to go for simultaneous treatment of TB and HIV. How long should we treat TB in an HIV-infected child where we just don't have controlled trials? This is a study from South Africa showing that on 6 months of TB treatment, recurrence was common, and of those who had recurrence, a third were thought to be due to relapse, not through lack of adherence, but because 6 months treatment did not sterilize the lesions. Multi-drug-resistant TB and extensive drug-resistant TB is a real concern, and this map here, the colouring of the country, shows the prevalence of MDR-TB, but it's the hatched areas which are alarming. These are countries which have reported extensive drug-resistant TB as of January 07. In May this year, 38 countries have been documented to report extensive of drug-resistant TB. And this widely publicized outbreak of XDR-TB in KwaZulu-Natal and Tukela Ferry really is frightening. This particular strain had increased transmissibility, and over 50% of patients were thought to have acquired this as primary infection. The mortality within 25 days of TB diagnosis was 98%, and every patient who had an HIV test was found to be HIV infected. And simply, children must have been infected with this strain, but of course, as we usually do not get the organism from a child with TB, they weren't diagnosed. And the idea that what we know about MDR-TB and extensive drug resistant TB is just the tip of an iceberg has to be correct. How much of this iceberg is due to resistant TB in children, and how many of them have co-infection with HIV, we have no idea. There are many other treatment challenges, and each and every bullet point on this slide merits its own discussion, but I don't have time to address any of these, and we'll move on to prevention challenges. And again, the first two bullet points here are vitally important, but I don't have time to talk about them. Isoniazid prophylaxis is topical. There is a study from South Africa showing a significant decrease, a randomized placebo-controlled study, good study, showing a significant decrease in tuberculosis and in mortality in children receiving isoniazid, such that the study was stopped halfway through. What this study does not answer is how long do we give isoniazid, because the risk of reinfection of children in this environment remains. And also, if this is widely adopted, might this have an influence on background isoniazid resistance in a country? We don't know that. BCG, there's a lot we don't know about it, but we do know that it's not good enough to protect HIV-infected children, and we've worried about its safety for many years, and the many case reports of disseminated BCG have come through. This is a study from Southern Africa showing that the risk for an HIV-infected infant of getting disseminated BCG is several hundred times higher than a non-infected child. And World Health actually have modified their advice on BCG in January this year, saying it should not be used in children known to be HIV infected. For my final slide, well, how are we going to meet these challenges? We need new diagnostic tests for TB, and there are many interesting and exciting ideas in the pipeline. We need new drugs to treat particularly resistant TB, and we need new vaccines to protect against TB. But we can't wait for this to come. We could do more now. We need more pediatric data. We need integrated care of tuberculosis and HIV for adults as well as children. And we need more rollout of antiretrovirals in pediatrics. And we need integrated family care, because children and families nearly with both these diseases, there is usually many are affected. And I think many in the audience will be saying, same old list, we've seen this year in, year out, and we will continue to see this same old list year in, year out, unless we can get more money into this area. We need massive investment. There are moves, and there is some optimism because more money is coming, but it's not enough, and it's up to every one of us to help keep pushing to better look after co-infection. Thank you.
This paper is open for discussion.
Thank you. I'm Dr. Sana. I'm from Cambodia. I have a specific question I want to ask you related to the efavirenz. Is there any study of efavirenz we can use for children who are under 3 years of age that have co-infection HIV with TB or co-infection HIV with hepatitis, or the child who are reaction to nevirapine. Is there any study that we can use efavirenz for children who are under 3 years?
If I think I understood your question, it's about the safety of nevirapine use with co-infected children. In tuberculosis co-infection, I have no concerns whatsoever using nevirapine in London, but I will measure therapeutic drug monitoring of nevirapine and make sure that I'm in the right therapeutic range. With co-infection of hepatitis viruses, I'm not aware of data, but it would be something that potentially we might be worried about.
Next question. We'll have the lady here.
Yes, Dr. Gilbert from Jamaica. Question about the disseminated BCG disease. In Jamaica, we use BCG at birth, and it has not been our experience to have the extent of disseminated disease that was reported in that paper. And my question is, now that the WHO has made this statement in 07, does it mean that we wait for the PCR results before we give the BCG? I mean, it's not really affecting us to that extent.
I don't think I'm qualified to answer that question because TB is such a problem. But I think the reality is that BCG does not protect HIV-infected children for long enough. I think it is sensible, the way they have worded it, that if you know the child is HIV-infected, to avoid giving it. Whether in some environments it is safe to wait for that time of knowing the child's HIV infection status, or maybe you just miss the opportunity to protect those who are uninfected. So it is very difficult. We do need a better vaccine. It's as simple as that. In London, I've looked after several HIV-infected children with disseminated BCG. So it's something which we've all seen. But the data from South Africa was, you're probably familiar with this study. There are several scenarios looking at transmission rate, and even with the most conservative way of looking at it, this was pretty worrying data.
We have a question from the lady there.
Yeah, Dr. Bach from Saudi Arabia. If we have a patient, a child with HIV and discovered to have a pulmonary TB and we have to shift the nelfinavir to efavirenz, for example, but for the age, for the weight of the patient, that we have to give the efavirenz as a half tablet, which is 300. So how much the bioavailability of the coated tablet instead of solution if we don't have the efavirenz solution, or a shortage of efavirenz solution?
Is there anyone from BMS in the audience for that? I don't know that. Do you not have efavirenz liquid?
We have, but sometimes we have a shortage.
Okay. I don't have an answer to that, and I have the luxury, in fact, of every child we start on antiretroviral therapy, we will do therapeutic drug monitoring, whether they've got TB or not, because we simply do not have enough PK data across the board in pediatric practice, and many of the doses we use, we're sort of guessing, and we quite often have to modify doses of several different antiretroviral agents. And I suppose what I'm saying is a plea for we need more pediatric data across the board, pediatric HIV, whether it's co-infection with TB. And I'm ashamed of us as an international community that we still don't do enough pediatric research.
Thanks very much. I think we're going to have to move on now. We'll have some time at the end, hopefully, to address some of the other questions.
So our last speaker is Rita Jeremy. She's a developmental psychologist from the Department of Pediatrics at UCSF. She's going to talk to us about neurocognitive aspects of pediatric HIV infection.
When children become very sick soon after birth and die in infancy or toddlerhood, the neurocognitive performance is not of primary concern, since they have to be taken care of anyway totally, even if they were healthy. But when children grow older, they are expected to become contributing members of their society, and then their neurocognitive functioning becomes critical to their daily life. Such skills as talking, understanding directions, learning new skills, remembering, using hands, making choices, planning. So as HIV-positive children continue to live longer when they can have access to heart, their neurocognitive functioning will become increasingly important, and even more so as they live into adulthood. In real life, HIV infection in children co-occurs almost always with one or more other major risk factors, each detrimental to children's development. Some of these risk factors are perhaps even more detrimental than HIV itself. Some of the other risk factors may be more common in certain areas or groups. Other co-occurring risk factors that can affect neurocognitive development are listed here. For example, prenatal alcohol exposure is a well-known risk factor for mental retardation, as is, for example, iodine deficiency, which is found among millions of people around the world. So how do researchers estimate the effects of HIV infection on neurocognitive functioning of HIV-positive children when there are so many co-occurring risk factors? There are two common approaches. One is comparison to own kind. One is to look at compared to test norms. And the comparison to own kind look at comparing children who are HIV-positive, positive moms, to HIV-negative, the seroreverters of positive moms, for example. In other cases, researchers compare the children's performance to standardized norms on large sample tests that have been standardized on large samples of children with very wide range of abilities. I have a few lectures here that I will have to skip. So what has been found to be typical neurocognitive functioning of HIV-positive children without antiretroviral therapy? The most documented evidence has been from the pre-ART period in Western countries. Unfortunately, even in the era of HART, the vast majority of HIV-positive children in developing countries do not have access to ART. They are the untreated. And so the natural history of HIV effects on neurocognitive functioning is still relevant to this group. HIV-positive children without ART are typically, their typical illness is development of encephalopathy. For many, the symptoms onset is very early in infancy with rapid progression and often leading to death in the first few years of life, sometimes actually during infancy. This is typically the progressive encephalopathy. If children are examined on standardized tests, one of the definitions, characterizations of progressive encephalopathy is decline in test scores from more than one standard deviation from norms of a test. But even without tests, you can see progressive encephalopathy from looking at milestones. Children are expected to gain milestones with age, and when they are not, or if they are not gaining any milestones, or even worse, losing milestones, that is a good definition that they have developed progressive encephalopathy. Also, their brain does not grow as fast, and there are some other characteristics. In contrast, static encephalopathy, children still acquire milestones, but at a slower rate, on a kind of a slower curve. This does not mean that they are eventually going to catch up because they're just slower and eventually they'll get to the same point of being normal, but it most likely means that they will lag behind norms and some of them will also start losing skills later on. When you look at some of the children who have more pronounced HIV health symptomology, they often are the older children who have had static encephalopathy. In terms of specificity, there is some evidence for certain areas being more specifically affected, but in general, you would say the predominant effects or of HIV infection in children are on global, lead to global deficits in neurocognitive performance and variety of domains. So that was about performance. When you look at what can be observed by biological markers related to brain, there's calcification of basal ganglia, commonly observed. Lesions in the white matter seen on MRI, the calcification seen on CAT scans. And there are also changes that can be seen on MRS of cortical metabolites, and was an interesting one is lower N-acetyl aspartate, the NAA, which is seems to be related to cognitive performance. Lower is worse. But a big puzzle still remains, which is how come there are some children who have never had any ART, their mothers never had any ART, and they still continue to, they're still alive, they're still school age or maybe even older, and they show at most some moderate effects on the neurocognitive functioning. Perhaps they have static encephalopathy. Some of the discoveries about host genes, genetics, may shed some light on it in the future. And of course, by the school age, these children are survivors of a cohort, of birth cohort, that by then a large percentage have died. In terms of timing of the initial infection, that may affect neurocognitive functioning. It can happen during gestation, labor, delivery, infancy, or later years. And generally, the effects on neurocognitive functioning are most severe and probably appear earlier for children who are infected in utero, and then probably not as fast in appearing or not maybe as severe for later infections, but there is a very wide range. Most of the initial infections actually happen during labor delivery. For children who are, and some children, of course, as we heard, are infected from breast milk during infancy, and for children who get infected later, either like hemophilia children or children from sexual abuse or sexual activity or their own IV intravenous drug use, their course becomes increasingly more like that of adults. So what is the picture of neurocognitive functioning of HIV-positive children who have been treated with antiretroviral medications? Results are quite limited because of very few large controlled studies with large number of participants. There are several small scales. Most of the studies are very small number studies with very small number of children. The small size, small scale studies have shown some improvements in neurocognitive performance, but generally not recovery back to baseline after neurocognitive decline has been already observed. And then some people have reported change in the cortical metabolites, that they have been able to increase some of the metabolites like this NAA, which is a good thing probably because it seems to be related to neurocognitive performance. Actually, some of them have suggested that that you may be able to see some of the decline in brain by looking at the cerebral metabolites before you get anatomical changes in the brain, as can be seen on the MRI. Of the large-scale control studies, there's a couple of big studies that looked at children pre- and post-availability of HART. In a big study that looked at when antiretrovirals were first introduced, there was a follow-up of children who were drug-naive to any ARVs, and then were randomly assigned to either AZT, DDI, or a combination. And in that particular very large study that took a lot of work, actually they did show improvement in neurocognitive scores of the children. A more recent, a very recent hot off the press a few months ago study and analyzed big data sets looking at children from the era, the cohort of the era pre-HART and the cohort of children in the HART availability era. And they looked at, and they, what they found was it was an for infants, they showed that mental and motor functioning of the HIV positive children remained, even after the availability of protease inhibitors, remained significantly lower than of HIV negative children, the seroreverters. They did put a little caveat saying that, however, against the background of declining scores of the HIV negative children, there was evidence of limited, very limited improvement of the HIV positive children relative to the uninfected peers. And this is after the introduction of PIs. And when they looked at infants who actually were the pre and post themselves, there was only a trend, not a really significant improvement, toward improved mental and motor scores after the initiation of PI therapy. And they actually were saying that they only saw evidence for very limited improvement with heart, even though, of course, there was very major biological change in terms of like viral load. Another recent study that looked at actual a report of which I'm the first author, compared neurocognitive functioning of a lot of children who are randomized to different regimens with a protease inhibitor, and that they were followed for at least a year. The children had been for at least 16 weeks on an NRTI and prior to entering the study, and they ranged all the way from 4 months to 17 years. At baseline, it was already evident that they were about one standard deviation below norms of tests. And the finding after 1 year, at least after 1 year, we did 13 different measures, and only one out of the 13 showed any improvement, and 12 out of the 13 showed no change over the overall. I mean, there might have been, you know, individual differences, but overall, in 12 out of the 13 measures, there was no difference after 1 year, basically 1 year, with a protease inhibitor. And as reported in the previous study, the changes in the viral load were dramatic, you know, great, great results. So while ART and especially HEART can achieve major improvements in the physical functioning of children and their health, as seen by the biological markers, HEART can do so without a corresponding significant improvement in neurocognitive functioning of these children. Still, there is some evidence, you know, hopeful evidence from some of the smaller studies, so it's worth pursuing. And, of course, questions why there is not equivalent improvements in neurocognitive functioning as there are in the biological, the other things. Some say that maybe there's not enough penetration into the cerebral spinal fluid. Perhaps some of the first effects are, the major effects are when you first get introduced when you are drug naive. So recommendations are more like suggestions. We need to have neurocognitive testing. If neurocognitive skills are becoming critical to their daily life, we need to know more about what they are and include them as part of comprehensive HIV care. We need to start testing neurocognitive skills early so that to identify either early signs of decline and if need be either initiate therapy if it hasn't been done so already, maybe intensify it or change the regimen. We need usable neurocognitive tests that are appropriate and economical both in time and cost for culture and language of the children. That's a very, very major issue. And some people actually who are studying populations, large populations in other settings, are renorming tests, Western tests for the local populations. We need to deliver antiretroviral drugs to children. A very small percentage, of course, as you've heard many times, are receiving them. And then a big behavioral issue is to help maintain adherence once they get the drugs. And that is a big issue. Whether it's someplace in a developing country where their child is already an orphan and has like 10 different people coming with a child and they don't know what to do and so on. But it's also a big issue in countries that there is lots of medication and they don't want to take something, especially when you get to be a teenager. So adherence is a real major issue. Another thing is to design drugs that actually work on brain. And I guess the end is that the most important thing, which works the best for neurocognitive development, is prevention of HIV in the first place. Thank you.
So, thank you, Rita. We have time for questions.
There's someone there.
Someone there? Yes.
thanks for this excellent lecture here.
Oh, is this from me?
Yeah.
Oh.
Well, it is, in fact, if the, Mr. Chairman allow me, it's two questions. First of all, I'm a pediatrician, but I can sometimes attend the clinic of adult HIV. From the clinical observation, which I noticed that after the antiretroviral therapy started for the adult HIV patients, their neurological assessment is really improved dramatically within weeks. So my first question is the non-improvement, the cognitive function in the children, because they have sort of the developmental brain and in children is something different from the adult. Number two, or we can answer the first question.
Okay, I heard it partially.
The adult neurological, I mean CNS involvement in adult HIV patients, once they start the heart therapy, they improve dramatically within weeks. So why not?
The children, you see.
No, this is an adult. But adult. Why it is not the case in pediatric? Is it because they have still developing neurons or what?
The story for children is very different than from adults, and I don't know that much about adults' changes. Some of the changes that are seen in sort of a case-by-case basis that you see the difference, often is the difference that the child, if you saw them before that they were sick, so they are like not doing things, they are tired, they are irritable, so sometimes you don't see sort of the optimal level what the child does, and then you see it when they get to be healthier. Whether there's something permanently that was already happening before, that they had permanent damage and then some damage and then the damage was undone, it's not clear.
Okay. The second question, is there any adjunctive therapy with the antiretroviral therapy, say, for example, immunoglobulin or something to enhance the blood-brain barrier to improve the HIV infection in the CNS?
I am a developmental psychologist, so I have to defer to people who deal with the medical aspect of it. There is actually some scale that some people that is being developed to see which medications and which combinations are more likely to be to cross the brain barrier, the blood-brain barrier. And I know that one of the ones that got a good rating was Keletra, but it's still not clear that whether even if it's more, if certain medications might be more likely to pass into the central nervous system, whether that would make a difference. But that is the first step. I mean, you have to have drugs that pass and then test them, but it's not clear yet whether which ones would really work.
Okay, thank you. We have a question.
Sorry. Hi, my name is Anne Ferrara. I've been working in the Netherlands and in South Africa. And I'm very happy that you ask about this neurodevelopmental screening, actually neurocognition and neurodevelopmental exams. We have one which we use in the Netherlands, which is called the Van Wieken scheme. It's a screening instrument used for children 0 to 4 years old. I would be very happy to contribute and work with you further in developing this, especially in the African setting. I'm sure there's other colleagues who are familiar with the earlier Gazelle developmental exam, which I was first trained on in 1978 in the United States, and that was especially for infants that were premature and fragile infants. So I think we could start with the early childhood in any case, but
I would be very glad to see that.
Yes.
One of the differences about developing scales for children to look at neurocognitive development of children as opposed to adults is that pretty much for adults they develop some scales that pretty much cover a wide range of ages, whereas when you're working with children from 0 to whatever you think is still childhood, sometimes 17, 18, there are such dramatic changes in what is expected at these different ages very fast from one age to another that you need to practically develop like multi tasks for these different ages to be appropriate for that age and yet be available for people from different countries, different languages, different environments. So it's much more challenging to look at development of tests for children, of children's neurocognitive development compared to adults. And not that developing tests for adults is easy, but it's even harder.
Can we allow, there's another question. Can we have another? We have another question here.
Dr. Waldy from South Africa. And just to comment on the neurodevelopmental side, I've got about 500 children on ARVs, and a lot of them are facing severe circumstances. I don't have any test that I can use to assess the neurocognitive function, but from just observing them in my practice, they're doing exceptionally well, considering what they're facing. I mean, they're facing poverty, orphans, all kinds of things, and these little kids are regaining milestones. They're doing exceptionally well. So if I could have something hard and concrete to measure them with, I think it's needed, especially when you've got 500 kids on ARVs. That was just a comment. But my other question is to, I think it was Professor Walters or Dr. Walters, I'm not sure. Sorry, this is just very quick. I do have so many children on ARVs, so a lot of them, all of them have had a BCG. We've seen a few now with BCG immune reconstitution disease. Now, I've been told that this is a new disease, a new entity. I've seen three children that have had big glands under the arm on the side that they got the BCG. What organism do you isolate from this? Is it Mycobacterium bovine from the vaccine? And how do you treat it? We're just pushing on through with the ARVs. I mean, that's all I can do. I'm not a pediatrician, I'm just a medical officer.
The short answer is I don't know how to treat it because I don't think there are randomized controlled trials. But if I have problems with BCG and if it's just local, I do treat with rifampicin and isoniazid for about 3 months. But the reality is that dead mycobacteria BCG bovis will still produce pus. So you don't always know you've got live organisms there. If it's disseminated and causing organ dysfunction, then we throw a lot more at it. Parazinamide will not have activity. Amikacin, you have to treat it very aggressively or it will kill the child.
Okay, one last question then. We are over time.
I'm from Nairobi, Kenya. I'm a pediatrician, and my comment is about BCG in HIV-infected children. And from my clinical observation, we have routine BCG immunization of our children at birth, and we do have still some mother-child transmission. However, it is relatively rare to see disseminated BCG. We see one or two cases in our tertiary referral hospital. Maybe one or two cases in the last 6 months out of thousands of HIV of children who are exposed. So I think from our clinical observation, it's not as frequent dissemination of ECG HIV infected children at birth, when they're usually not at advanced stage.
I think that's right, but once HIV is advanced, the microbiological distinction of BCG and MTB requires culture and sophisticated laboratory backup. And I would predict that there are many children dying in Africa with a diagnosis of TB when in fact it could be disseminated BCG. I don't have any data to back that up, but it's certainly, we know it can act as a pathogen, and if your immune competence continues to decay, it is quite likely there are live BCG there which can act as a pathogen and kill you. But I don't have data for that.
Okay, well, I think we've had a very interesting session here. And once again, I'd like you to join me in thanking our four speakers.